Hopefully the others are watching us on TV. Today we are going to be listening to and learning about housing and different facets of housing. And I don't know if all of you have this handout, but it seems like the heading on that handout is "Lack of Housing Inspires New Alliances." Is a good explanation of what has driven the interest in housing across the state of Minnesota. And when I read this article, it talked about a number of communities in Senate District 1, which is way up in the northwest corner of the state, and how housing is important for economic development and growth. It's important for, obviously, the some of the projects that we viewed for those who don't have housing. It's important for those people who have a job but can't quite qualify for housing. And it just has such a wide spectrum of interested parties. And so I hope today, as we listen to the testimony, some of those constituencies in that spectrum can lay out the need that we should be addressing in the housing area. So we have quite a list, and we'll try to work our way down, and we'll start out with the Commissioner of Housing, Ms. Thingerthal. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And to introduce the people with me, on my left is Tanya Orr, who is our Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development. And on my right is Katie Topinka, who is our Legislative Director. And they've been meeting with many of your members and thought it would be convenient to have them available for questions should you have them. So thank you very much for asking us to be here today. I'd like to talk for just a minute about the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which I think is a pretty remarkable story for the state of Minnesota. Our agency was formed more than 40 years ago and originally was formed because of the ability to issue federally tax-exempt bonds to provide below-market interest rate housing, both for first-time home buyers and for rental properties. And Minnesota has one of the strongest, if not the strongest, housing finance agency in the country. It has been very conservatively, fiscally managed over the years. And what that means is not only are we able to utilize federal resources, including tax-exempt bonds and low-income housing tax credits, which, by the way, I just came back from Washington, and there was a draft by Chairman Camp in the House of possible tax reform measures, and the 9% low-income housing tax credit was one of those few tax measures that were recommended for remaining in Chairman Camp's draft. So we are pleased that the House has seen the importance of that tool, and you'll hear more about how we use that tool as we go along in our presentation. We've been able to combine those federal resources over the years with state resources, and those resources for us really come in two pieces. We were here last year before the legislature with our appropriations bill, and we use those dollars for a variety of programs, including rental assistance for those who have experienced homelessness, all the way to the Workforce Housing Initiative that you chose to fund last year. This year we're here to talk about the second part of our funding component, and that is general obligation bonds for public housing and housing infrastructure bonds for that affordable housing that is privately owned. As we indicated here, we finance affordable housing for low and moderate income households while fostering strong communities. And over the last year, we've visited many communities, including Roseau, Worthington, Jackson, Duluth, all areas that are experiencing economic growth but shortage of housing. So just to talk for a moment about our most recent year and to give you an idea of scale and scope of what we do in any given year at Minnesota Housing, last year we served more than 63,000 households with all of our variety of programs, including housing counseling, rental assistance, and new construction of projects. That totaled $781 million, almost $800 million of spending from all sources. And some of the highlights out of that are that of the homeowners that we served, better than half of them have incomes below $50,000. That's a pretty remarkable track record in that Minnesota Housing has traditionally served some of the lowest income home buyers and done that very successfully without suffering a high level of foreclosures on those borrowers during the economic downturn. We assisted more than 15,000 homebuyers last year, with almost a quarter of those being households of color, households that are currently not being well served by the traditional capital markets. And 75% of all the renters that receive various kinds of assistance through programs that our agency administers had annual incomes of under $20,000. I think the message I'd like to leave with you is that we really cover a broad spectrum of housing needs throughout the state, really understanding that people at all levels of income and walks of life really do have a basic need that they share, and that is housing that they can afford. The governor's proposal within his bonding bill is for $50 million in bonding authority out of whatever your capital investment spend will be. $40 million of that would be for housing infrastructure bonds. That's for bonds to work with properties that are owned not by public entities. And $10 million in general obligation bonds for public housing areas. This investment would build or rehabilitate an estimated 2,500 housing units. So why is this so important now? Why do we think that this belongs in a capital investment bill? Well, our most recent statistics tell us that over 600,000 households in Minnesota pay more than 30% of their income for housing. That's almost one in three Minnesota households. If you look at renters, that percentage is even higher, upwards of 50%. And sadly, even today, as we're seeing an economic upturn in Minnesota, still more than 10,000 Minnesotans are homeless on any given day. And what really makes me very sad is that children with their parents make up a third of that homeless population. And unfortunately, as we've made progress in serving homeless individuals, sadly, the number of homeless families and children has increased. Communities are still recovering from the foreclosure crisis. We've seen a lot of good rebound in house prices when you look at the averages, but there are still communities, notably the north side of Minneapolis, the east side of St. Paul, where we're making steady progress, but where there are still vacant houses and where the overall neighborhood health has not yet returned. And finally, our state's Section 8 portfolio, those are properties where we receive rental assistance that is attached to the actual properties, is aging. Most of it is between 35 and 40 years old now and needs capital investment for rehabilitation. And it's really those three priorities that we're coming to you today with this bonding request. Let's talk first about the GO bonds for public housing. That would be $10 million to rehabilitate and preserve 1,700 public housing units. You'll hear more about this area from some of the people later on the agenda, but just suffice it to say that public housing in Minnesota serves 36,000 households, 12,000, a third of those are children, and more than 65% of the people in public housing have incomes below $15,000. Also, a tremendous number of public housing units are for the elderly. And many of you who particularly are from greater Minnesota know that that public housing for elderly in your community can sometimes be the only truly affordable housing that's available to very low-income seniors. Also, more than 90% of public housing units are more than 20 years old. In 2012, we came and made the case to you for $5.5 million in general obligation bonds to help 950 public housing units, and those investments were made in communities around the state, ranging from the Twin Cities to communities throughout the state. And I know you'll hear more about that from one of our future speakers. 14 projects were included in the funding from that $5.5 million. We hear here from our resident of St. Paul Public Housing saying how deeply grateful she is to St. Paul Public Housing for providing her with a home when she did not have any and was welcomed with open arms. Sometimes I think we forget about our public housing, partly because it is tends to be so very well managed in Minnesota. We don't have the housing public housing scandals of other communities, and it does provide a real safety net for those who are of the lowest income. Moving on to the housing infrastructure bonds, we're requesting $40 million to preserve, rehabilitate, and construct more than 800 units of affordable housing. There are three eligible uses that address those three needs I talked about earlier: the preservation of federally assisted housing, foreclosure recovery, and supportive housing for those who need housing with services because they have experienced homelessness or at risk of homelessness. We do have, I think, a good track record with the dollars you entrusted with us in the 2012 legislature, with $27.1 million in housing infrastructure bonds having leveraged $74.6 million in total development. So the housing infrastructure bonds made up only about a third of the total investment that we were able to make throughout the state. Leveraging, we get two levels of leverage with these funds. So for every $1 of state funding for the gap financing, for preservation, we leverage about $3 in private capital funding. Not only that, but the reason that we have had such a strong commitment to preserving that federally assisted housing is that for every $1 in state funding, it preserves $4 in federal assistance. With project-based Section 8 and rural development housing, the dollars that come into the state actually make up the difference between the rent charge for the property and 30% of the income for that family. So it's really tailored to each family and their ability to pay. An example of a project that we were able to assist with the 2012 housing infrastructure bonds is the Eastport Apartments in Mankato, where we rehabilitated 78 units of federally assisted housing. These were 1-, 2-, and 3-bedroom, one-bedroom apartments and 2- and 3-bedroom townhomes. Mankato is another community where we've had one of our community dialogues and really learned about the very dramatic shortage of housing of all kinds in Mankato. A second example here in the Twin Cities is one of the uses of housing infrastructure bonds is to be able to allow community land trusts to be able to buy property on which they can then put into their community land trust and then either rehabilitate or build properties that can be long-term affordable to lower-income households who want to have an alternative opportunity into being a homeowner. Just one technicality with the use of housing infrastructure bonds, it's clear in our Constitution that they can be used for rental properties and various uses within rental properties. However, for home ownership properties, the only use that they can be put to is for the land. So that's why there aren't more proposals within housing infrastructure bonds for single-family housing uses. We do utilize our appropriated dollars through our Economic Development Challenge Fund to provide community land trusts with gap financing that allows them to actually rehabilitate the home or build a new home on community land trust land that is purchased with housing infrastructure bonds. Just another quote, and this is from a land trust homeowner, saying it would be impossible to own my own home without the help of Homes Within Reach and their funders, close to work and close to daycare. So we really are helping people who otherwise would not be able to afford to become homeowners. The final use for the housing infrastructure bond dollars is foreclosure recovery. I'm sorry, the third use is, example is a project in North Minneapolis called West Broadway Curve, which is a new construction project. Now you're saying to yourself, how can new construction of rental housing be foreclosure recovery? Well, what happened in North Minneapolis is there are a tremendous amount of single-family properties that were very old, very deteriorated, that either the city or the county acquired when those properties were foreclosed on. And this particular property is being built on a piece of land that was assembled from previously foreclosed properties. It is currently under construction and will provide affordable family housing, affordable to the local workforce, and is in the Northside Achievement Zone, which is a very strong project to help families really help their children succeed in school. This project also received funding from the Met Council, from the Federal Home Loan Bank, from the City of Minneapolis, and from DEED for the commercial property that's available there. Just hearing from one of the downtown Minneapolis communities that also was very instrumental in this project, Janice Anderson from Christian Life Basilica of St. Mary, says we're excited to be working with Common Bond Communities to transform empty lots on the north side into permanent, high-quality housing with resident services at the site. And finally, supportive housing. This is housing that's permanent housing, permanent affordable housing that has services that are tailored to the families that will live in that housing. This one happens to be in north central Minnesota and is the Jawanakaman Project on the White Earth Indian Reservation. And for those of you who know that part of the state, it is actually in Nativash, a very poor part of the state. And they were fortunate enough to have a piece of land that was available for development immediately adjacent to the Workforce and Training Center, so that families that will move into these 20 units will have immediate walking access to the Workforce Training Center and the Community Center. We have worked very closely with the Department of Human Services to provide the service dollars for this project, and they are extremely excited to finally have supportive housing that's suitable for families on the White Earth Reservation. And Chairwoman Irma Weisner from White Earth has said, this project provides good quality housing and services tailored to fit the needs of each family and help people stabilize their lives. So you might ask, how does this process work? If you allocate these dollars to the Housing Finance Agency, how do we go about selecting projects? And how do we utilize the bond proceeds? They are appropriation bonds, and what that means is that the state makes a standing appropriation to pay the debt service. And the reason that we utilize housing infrastructure bonds is that most affordable housing, because of the way various federal funds are structured, are not owned by government entities. They're owned by private entities. And the state constitution does not allow us to use general obligation bonds for housing that is not owned by public entities. And so you have found it appropriate to establish these appropriation bonds in the past to allow us to work with the housing infrastructure that we do have. They'll serve low and moderate income families, people that cannot afford adequate housing without assistance, and help improve substandard housing conditions. So how this works is that the legislature authorizes the housing infrastructure bonds. Developers compete for those funds through an annual request for proposal process, and owners agree in return for that to maintain that housing affordability for at least 20 years. So how does that compare to the need for these funds? Every year, the agency typically receives 3 to 4 times as many requests as it is able to fund. And these are not just any proposals. These are really good, fundable proposals. In 2013, we funded 20% of the requests that received for deferred loans for rental housing, and that's how we use the housing infrastructure bonds, and 42% of the requests for funds for home ownership. And in 2013, housing infrastructure bonds were not available. So we're helping that we can increase those percentages and meet more of the need with really good projects that are already in the pipeline. The capital investments that we made in housing for 2012, housing infrastructure bonds, 17 projects totaling $60 million, and general obligations bonds for 27 projects totaling $56 million. So this is for the last 10-year period of time during which the legislature has from time to time provided bonding allocations to the agency for housing. Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation, and we're happy to take questions from the committee.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. It was an excellent presentation. I hope that we can get your slides so that we can share the presentation with all the members that are here.
Absolutely.
I have a couple of questions that if you could just touch on. One of them is, could you just address the loan repayment rate that you have, and how does that compare with other states?
Could I ask, are you speaking about rental properties, homeownership properties?
I think maybe both, if you would.
Certainly. We make a variety of loans with our various resources. In many cases, we'll make a amortizing regular payment loan. And remarkably, at this current time, we do not have a single loan that is not making its payments. We have no loans that are in default, and that has tended to be the track record over the years for the amortizing loans that we make on these properties. With regard to deferred payment loans, these are loans which are intended to stay in the property for very long periods of time that make up the gap between the equity that's brought to the table and the amortizing first mortgage that is repaid. However, we don't just walk away from those dollars. We don't treat them as grants, but we do, in most cases, put a lien on the property and then expect that we will sort of revisit whether that money should stay in the property if there's a time when the owner is going to refinance a mortgage or if they're going to sell the property to someone else. If there is an opportunity, the property's been performing well, and it looks like there's the opportunity for those loans to be repaid, we do require them to be repaid. So it's really very much a case-by-case basis. I'm really very pleased to say that with regard to deferred loans, we have an outstanding group of owners in Minnesota that have maintained their ownership and maintained their commitment to affordable housing for, in many cases, upwards of 40 years. And so we haven't seen a dramatic number of opportunities to recapture those deferred payment dollars.
Okay. think we visited one of those places in either Mankato or Rochester.
In Rochester.
And then if you could touch on, is there a limit as to how much federal money the state could match in terms of leverage?
Mr. Chair, yes, and let me talk about a couple of resources. So with regard to the rental assistance that we receive on Section 8 properties, that is really it really effectively is capped out by the federal budget, and since it really it depends on which particular set of tenants is living in a given building, the federal government does that on kind of a forecasting basis. Funding has been very tight the last several years, and we expect it will continue to be tight. But we have not experienced a shortage of funding in any Minnesota projects in this past year. So we've had owners that have been managing very tight to the line in order to make that the case. We also receive federal home dollars. That's a program through the Department of Housing and Urban Development that we utilize in projects. And that funding has been dramatically cut over the last several years. And in fact, the level of funding for the federal home program has now been cut back to the level that it was at in 1993 with no adjustment for inflation. I was just, as I said, in Washington yesterday, really visiting with our congressional delegation and expressing concern about the fact that that has been a greatly shrinking dollar amount. So those are our two main federal resources. With regard to low-income housing tax credits, that amount is allocated based on the population of the state, and it is adjusted slightly each year depending on how the population estimates change. But the buying power of those dollars does not go up commensurate with the increase in construction costs, for example.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is, what is the 1993 level in a dollar figure that we can count on from the federal government for this year and the next year?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I do not recall that number off the top of my head. I apologize. It's about $8 million.
And then I had another question regarding the privately owned housing through the housing infrastructure bonds that are required to be affordable for 20 years. And we have some good owners that are using up to 40 years of affordability for tenants. Can you tell us what, and I'm not sure if we're past the 20-year mark for these loans, but how many people have been uprooted because there's no longer affordability in some of those units? Do you have a number on that?
I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Orr if she can recount for us the largest number of losses were really in the late 1990s and 2000s when the first contracts came up. Do we have a number on that, Tanya?
We have in the past, Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, we have set a goal for ourselves of preserving more than 95% of the units that could possibly be lost in any one year, and we have always exceeded that goal.
Excuse me, could
you
move the microphone closer right in front of you, please? Thank you.
So we have always exceeded the goal of preserving more than 95% of the units that are potentially lost in any one year. As the commissioner said, we did lose a couple of buildings in the late 1990s, but we have preserved virtually all of the remaining units that have been potentially lost in the recent years.
Okay, Senator Thomas, let me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, maybe you mentioned this already, but This is a $50 million request, and I know there's $100 million. Is this thing on? There's $100 million request out there somewhere. Might even be in a bill. But how far does this get us to where we want to get to? I see we can do 2,500 housing units with $50 million. What's the actual need? And I don't know if that'd be dollar amounts or if that'd be housing units or what do we know what that is?
Well, as we mentioned, there are 600,000 families in or households in Minnesota that are paying more than 30% of their income for rent, or for housing costs, I should say, not for rent. And so that is a real affordability need. And I think the other indicator of need is, as we indicated, every year when we put our dollars out for competition, we have 3 to 4 times as many applications for dollars. And these are not, you know, this isn't just fill in a, boy, nice to do this project. These are detailed applications regarding very specific projects on very specific sites. And so we are able to fund 1 out of every 4 applications that comes to the door. And to even be an application, you have to demonstrate that the need exists in that community and that the market would exist to support a project like that. So that gives you some idea that we are, you know, chipping away every year at about 25% of the pipeline.
So,
Senator Thomason.
Chairman, so if you had 4 times as much money, would you be able to meet all of the requests, or would you just because of administrative limitations, you still would only be able to do 1 in 4?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, but my guess is that the number of requests probably would increase. Because there are certain projects that don't come to the table just because people know we have a limitation on funds.
And, Mr. Chairman, I see there's a statistic in your handout of 75,000 underwater mortgages in Minnesota. And I thought you made a comment earlier to the effect that Minnesota's foreclosure rate is way lower than in other states. And so are those two things affiliated with each other? And then what is our percentage of foreclosures that is way lower than in every other state?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I do not have that number with me. And the thing that I would point out about this is that the foreclosure recovery has been very uneven. There are certain counties, we have these maps on our website, that certain census tracts, certain areas that are still very much above the average with foreclosures, and other areas where the recovery has been quite good. So looking at the average numbers gives a very misleading picture. So I would just say that these resources would be focused on those areas where there is still a ways to go in terms of the foreclosure recovery.
I'm not sure who was first, but Senator Ingebrigtsen and then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, could you zero in a little bit on the homeless piece of this for us? How many Minnesota, or do we know, do we have the ability to know how many Minnesotans are homeless that don't have stable housing, and what are we doing about it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, thank you for asking that question. We do have in this state something that we do every 3 years called the Wilder Survey, done with the Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. Where on a given night in the winter, census takers literally fan out and take the census of those that are homeless, those that are in homeless shelters, those that are sleeping in cars or under bridges, doubled up. And it's not an easy thing to do, but there are literally thousands of volunteers that assist with this survey once every 3 years. And so there are also sort of briefer censuses that are taken every year called the point in time count. And we know from the last Wilder survey that there are more than 10,000 individuals homeless in Minnesota, and that unfortunately there's been growth in the number, of the overall number, and the growth has primarily increased among families with children and among unaccompanied youth. The state of Minnesota adopted a plan to end long-term homelessness back in the mid-2000s, and we did, in fact, by focusing on chronically homeless individuals and veterans. In both of those cases, we actually reduced the number of chronic homeless and the number of veterans that were homeless, and we have one of the, I'm proud to say, we have one of the lowest veteran homeless counts in the country, and we have a real possibility of effectively ending veterans homelessness in Minnesota if we stay focused on that goal. In December of last year, the state's Interagency Council on Homelessness, which includes 11 commissioners from 11 state agencies and is co-chaired by myself and Commissioner Jessen, published our new plan to prevent and end homelessness. And in that, we cover really a wide variety of activities that focus very much on the prevention of homelessness, things like working with the Department of Human Services to make sure that when kids are exiting foster care, for example, that there is a place for them to go. Also working with the Department of Corrections so that when individuals are leaving after serving their sentence, there is a place for them to go. There's really, I think, very a heartwarming collaboration among the agencies committing to bring forward ideas and solutions for how we can really chip away at it by both constructing new housing and providing new affordable housing as we're presenting today, but also at really pulling out all the stops to prevent homelessness in the first place. And so this is this bonding request is really the first of the items that was on our list, because we do know that even if we're 100% successful with preventing homelessness, we still have a shortage of affordable units for people to stabilize their lives in.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up, and I'm glad you mentioned the plan to end homelessness by 2020, I believe it was, and I was part of that years ago. And so you mentioned that, supportive housing, but how close are we? We're very close chronologically here to 2020, and how close are we to ending homelessness by 2020? And specifically, I assume we're talking about those 10,000 Minnesotans that are homeless. And is it a lack of funding? Is it a lack of facilities, services? I'm just kind of trying to zero in. Prevention is so important, and an ounce of prevention is definitely worth a pound of cure. But I'm really wanting to kind of zero in on those 10,000 homeless Minnesotans and wonder, you know, how are we going to get to that? How are we going to get to ending homelessness by 2020? And I'd just like to hear from you on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, again, thank you for asking that question. This is such an incredibly important priority for the state, because not only is homelessness a horrible burden for those to whom it happens to, but it's also a very expensive burden for the state, because having a family live in an emergency shelter is a very expensive proposition. And actually, by providing permanent affordable housing, so someplace for people to go so they don't become homeless, is really a key part of solving this problem. So part of it, frankly, is the fact that the affordability of housing in Minnesota has been getting worse. It's a combination. It's sad but true that our improving economy has meant that overall rents in the marketplace have gone up, and wages for people who are working at very modest levels have stayed fairly stagnant. And so those two lines are diverging, and that means that more people have just a basic housing affordability problem. Just to give you a comparison, in the early 2000s, the percentage of of households in Minnesota that paid more than 30% of their income for rent was 20% of households. Now it's more than 30% of households. So those lines have just been getting farther and farther apart, and that means that it's tougher and tougher for more households to be able to just afford basic solid housing. And so you have just more people that one bad thing happens to them, they lose a job, they have an illness, and can no longer afford the housing to be available to them. That said, I think one of the things that we learned from the business plan to end long-term homelessness, where the goal was to provide 4,000 units of permanent supportive housing, we reached that goal at the end of last year. And that means that there are 4,000 people who are now in a setting that is not only affordable, but also provides services that people need. And these are people perhaps that have suffered from mental illness, suffered from chemical dependency, suffered from other needs that are medical in nature. Those services are now being provided in conjunction with that housing. And there has, frankly, been a shortage of funding for those services. And so progress on the number of units was slower than we had hoped, and it will continue to be an issue as we move into the future.
Mr. Chair, follow-up, please.
Then we have to move on.
Just one follow-up. Could you provide for us or for me a trend line of our number of homeless Minnesotans? I know you're getting that data every year, and I'd just like to see what that trend line is. Thank you very much.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the very informative report. Being a new capital investment committee member, I have a new capital investment committee member question, and I would like to talk to you a little bit about the RFP process. So in interest of moving along, Mr. Chair, if I could just simply ask the commissioner to have somebody come in and see me for a 15-minute appointment so I can talk about that and better understand the process, statewide process. Being a rural member, I'm certainly not worried about the process, but I'm concerned that I just need to be informed on the RFP process for housing in the metro suburb area versus rural. So if you would do that, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we'd be delighted to do that. And I will say that in the last couple of years, we understand that part of the way that projects get funded is that we see the projects in the first place. And that's why we've been holding these community dialogues around the state to work with local city council members, developers, et cetera, and helping them to understand our process so that they can actually put forward good competitive proposals.
Thank you very much.
And Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't need an extensive answer. I just maybe want to get a flavor, and perhaps we could talk about this offline as well a little bit more. But while it is the policy, or at least and or the practice of the state to work on affordable housing, affordable needs, is it also the policy of the state or your agency to work on frankly working people off of or out of affordable housing into their own, or are there any collaborative efforts with other agencies towards that effort?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, thank you for that question. I think one of the real strengths of the Minnesota Housing Program is that we do have an entire spectrum of financial products that do allow people to move from, for example, affordable rental housing into home ownership. We have a track record that I'd love to share with you of having worked, for example, with the St. Paul Public Housing Authority, where hundreds of families who were public housing residents worked with counselors to save a down payment and eventually become homeowners. Earlier in February, we convened several groups to talk about an item that we included in our affordable housing plan this year, which is an enhanced counseling program that would exactly replicate that that idea of identifying those who are currently in rental housing in various situations and working with them for those who are interested in becoming homeowners on what the responsibilities of homeownership are, how much down payment they'll have to save, and how they might need to address any credit issues that they might have and really put them on a path to homeownership. So something we feel deeply about, and we'll continue to focus on that in our overall programs.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner, so much. You're such a wonderful resource, and I think you have some excellent programs that we could spend more time, but I think we have to move on. But thank you for sharing that.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Mr. Hemmerlin from Red Wing. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, if I could go first to introduce the kind of panel.
Sure. If you want to please introduce yourself and or give your name for the record.
Yep.
Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Liz Coppola. I work as Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you for having this hearing today. It's Homeless Day on the Hill. We have 600 folks from around the state, some who are currently homeless, some in the room and wandering around the Capitol talking with legislators, and some who were homeless recently, but now because of the progress we've made on addressing homelessness are housed, and we'll be hearing from some of them here today sharing their story, and then also hear service providers who work across the state, community volunteers, and others. We're also here, I serve as co-chair of the Homes for All Alliance, a connection of housing advocates and homeless advocates, but also joined by community developers, labor, educators, redevelopment authorities, and others coming together around this Bill SF 1977, your bill, the $100 million for housing, which we believe will create or rehab 5,000 units. Not all, as the commissioner was saying, not all homeless units, but we really see as a homeless community that when we preserve existing federally subsidized housing, we stabilize communities impacted by foreclosure, we can construct and rehab supportive housing and rehab public housing. It really is the whole package we need. So we're here as the Homes for All Alliance speaking with one voice in strong support of this bipartisan effort. We see a growing recognition in Minnesota that housing stability means kids do better at school, that housing stability means workers do better at work, that housing stability creates stronger communities, that housing stability makes good economic sense with a solid return on investment. As the commissioner mentioned, this investment that we're seeking is in line with the state's plan to end and prevent homelessness, has broad support, and really, as she mentioned as well, the need is indisputable. She talks about the 10,000 who are homeless. We often talk about 14,000. The difference is we can't always count up every single person. For those of us in rural areas, we know it's hard to go and find every single person, but there's ways of estimating that. And so there's an estimated 14,000 Minnesotans homeless every night. And then, as she mentioned, we know when we make smart and targeted investments, we can see real progress, as we have with making a real dent in veterans homelessness and on track to be the first state to end veterans homelessness. So there's a whole lineup of service providers, policy experts, and others here who can say more, and I'll stay up here as they run through. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for outlining that, and we'll turn to you and Mr. Hammerlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members. My name is Randall Hammerlin. I'm the executive director of the Red Wing Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and I'm also the president of Minnesota NARO. And NARO stands for the Minnesota Chapter of National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. We represent 163 public housing authorities and housing development authorities in the state of Minnesota, and we range from very large authorities such as Minneapolis Public Housing, St. Paul Public Housing, to smaller HRAs in the state that may only take care of 35 units as their portfolio. But we are the voice of these PHAs and the HRAs across the state. With that, I want to say thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. We are asking for you to consider today in the upcoming bonding bill, which is very important to the health of our residents, the health of our communities in our state. And we want you to know that public housing represents about 20,000 units across the state, so this bonding bill for us is very important. I conservatively feel that our 20,000 units across the state is worth about $3.5 billion in housing in replacement value. So $20 million is doesn't sound like a lot of money when you compare it to $3.5 billion, but it is a tremendous help to us, as I'll speak as we go on later here, as what has happened on the federal level. And many of our public housing units were built in the 1960s and 70s, and they are at the stage today where maintenance means capital replacements. By that I mean such things as windows, doors, roofs, parking lots, sprinkler systems, and mechanicals. And these are just needing to be replaced because they're getting old. And sometimes we have to have upgrades that need to be done, such as in elevators and handicap accessibility standards, and because they have changed over the last 40 years. So what I'm here today to ask you is to and let you know that Minnesota NARO is asking for the support for $20 million in the bonding bill and $100 million for the overall bill. We are still at that number in our recommendation. Now, last year was a very difficult year for us in HRAs and PHAs across the nation and in Minnesota. And you all remember the budget battles that were going on at the congressional level and also at the state level, sequestration, I should say. These budget actions hit our HRAs hard, and I'm here to say that it was just not last year, but it's been going on for the last few years. So these things are accumulating on us. Now, I want to go over a little bit of our background on public housing in Minnesota. So one of the things that we do have, we are under a statute called 469, and that gives us our legal authority to operate. And in this particular slide, and I won't read it, it gives us a number of things that we're asked to look at, and I'll just give an example. Last year I did a blight study for Red Wing, of which now this year we're going into the into a small cities development loan or grant program with DEED, and of that we'll ask for 10 houses to be rehabbed because they were identified as blight. So these things are very important for us, and these powers are used out there. We acquire and we sell property, we issue bonds, and do a number of different things. Now, I did a needs assessment in 2009, and I can confirm that the need for housing in Red Wing shows that we're at about 2 to 3% vacancies down there, which means that we should be in a building mode. And we're looking at doing another housing needs assessment in 2014, and I don't think it's going to change whatsoever. Next. Now, Commissioner Tingerthal mentioned there's 600,000 Minnesota households pay 30% or more of their income, and we agree with that. And I wanted to just share with you what the overburden means, because if you look at someone that's on Social Security, it's not uncommon them to be somewhere in a $12,000 a year income range. And it's really simple math. You know, we use 30% adjusted income for our numbers. So 12,000 times 30% is 3,600. Dollars, divide that by 12 months, it's $300 a month. That is what they can afford to pay when they're in our public housing units. If they had to go out into the market in Red Wing, they'd pay at least $620 for the same unit. So right there immediately, their rent burden is twice what they can afford. It's just that simple. Next slide. And this shows the since 1980, the experience, the increase in the number of people that are in households who pay more than 30%, and you can see from this graph that it has gone up, just as Mayor, or as Commissioner Fingerthal said, from the 20s into the 33% and now 30% range of those paying 30% or more of their income, and then also those paying 50% or more of their income has increased from 8%, and now 2012 is 12%. The slide shows that the lower income group under $50,000 are more likely to pay a rent or a housing cost that is considered overburdened. And what I think this slide tells to us is this is just showing you that housing is a basic need. I mean, every one of us needs housing. And you cannot, just because you make less money, doesn't mean you can't have, you can have no place to live. You end up paying more of your income for that rent. Next slide. Renters make up 27% of the state's household in Minnesota. Now, this is census data. And if you look at the census data, you'll realize that Minnesota is actually number two in home ownership, which is 73%, the opposite of 27%, of course. But what I want to say to you is be careful about numbers like this, because having high ownership numbers doesn't necessarily always mean a good thing. It might mean that people are living in steps. They may own a house, but it's substandard. So we have to be a little cautious with that. So we do need to keep a strong inventory of rental housing available to people. We don't want to just say, oh, they should all own housing. There's always a place in people's lives where they may find they need a rental property. So I just wanted to caution you on that. We see the vacancy rates in the metro area, and I just would say this is the same rates that we see in Red Wing. It's about 2.5%, 3%. And, of course, our rents continue to climb over the years. This particular rent is showing the market rents, $984 in the metro areas. Next. This is just a map that shows the various percentage of households that are renting. Again, I'm going to just caution us, don't just keep in mind that high ownership rates don't necessarily mean this is a good thing. Next. And then this is just the kind of the correlation of those that are in the area they're paying those higher rents. And you know, it's, those counties are right alongside of the, which ones are renting the most. The shortage of affordable rental housing in 84 out of 87 counties, there's a shortage of these affordable and available units, and for extremely low-income renters. And extremely low-income renters in our world is 30% average medium income, area median income, and low income is 50% or under. So we're looking at about half of the 84 counties need to at least double their efforts in rental housing to meet the basic needs. Next. And the snapshot, the demand, it just makes sense. This that as the rents for market rates, and this is market rates, go up because of the demand, it gets to be more and more difficult for the landlord to justify renting at a lower number. So we're looking at from 2009, it was 8% at 30% of the area median income, now down to 4%. Who do we serve? We serve the extremely low and low-income housing households. And we have, like I said earlier, we have 20,000 public housing units and 30,000 housing choice vouchers across the state that work with landlords and over 10,000 units of rural development housing, Section 515. HRAs manage and maintain these units as a public asset, and we have property management at the Red Wing Housing Redevelopment Authority. I have 13 members on staff, but due to the budget cuts in the last few years, I'm down at least 3 full-time equivalents. And one other thing I want to mention about this too is that I'm very thankful for both grants from HUD. Housing Urban Development and Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They are allowing us to provide social service coordinators for our two towers in Red Wing. And the reason that's so important is our demographics in these towers is changing tremendously. We're finding that they're going more from an elderly complexes to elderly plus disabled. The difference in the last few years has been tremendous. We used to be about 90% elderly, 10% disabled. Today we're at 60% elderly and 40% disabled. And we need these social service coordinators in order to make these properties work properly. And of course, this map just shows the various public housing in the cities across the state that have public housing by county. Next. And the households we serve, 75% of public housing residents have annual incomes under $12,000. 64% of the households are headed by seniors or those with disabilities, and one-third of public housing residents are children, many at risk of being homeless or recently homeless. Now, I'm just going to touch on a little bit of how our Housing Choice Vouchers program. This is a program that has really taken a hit in the last year. And it's funded, of course, and monitored by HUD. The administration fees have been significantly reduced. I, in the past, have been budgeting between about anywhere from $12,000 to $20,000, $24,000 of city levy funds in order to administer the 169 housing vouchers that we have in Red Wing. I just got the numbers for the year-end last year. It turned out to be $30,000. And this is city levy funds that go in order to support this program. And this is not unusual across the state.
Do you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hammerlin, so just for the sake of the committee, the Housing Choice Voucher Program is what most people know as Section 8.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's
and that
correct.
The issue has been at the federal level as they've started to make those cuts via sequestration and other cuts to HUD. They have cut your administrative cost and you're backfilling those with city levy
dollars.
That's
correct.
In order to administer them, is that right?
And an increasing amount every year.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure the committee knew that.
Thank you, Senator Hayden.
Why that's so important also is that those people that do not have those vouchers, they need to find housing somewhere else. They're going to be automatically rent overburdened. They come to us on the public housing side or the Section 8 project-based side, and they look for housing as well. In Red Wing, we have a waiting list for our Section 8 voucher program of about it changes from year to year, but right now we're probably at about 280 people on the waiting list. It's about a 3 to 5 year waiting list. We purge it. It goes to about 150. It goes right back up to 270. So the demand for this kind of housing is tremendous. Next. And, of course, the fiscal impacts on our HRAs, I've already mentioned it. There's tremendous pressure on us in order to keep these programs going. And I'll talk about that a little bit in a bit here with a little bit more of our presentation. Next. Again, we're asking for $100 million in bonding for affordable housing, $20 million for public housing rehab, $80 million for housing infrastructure. And I mentioned earlier we have $3.5 billion worth of replacement value if across the state for our 20,000 units. It's such a tremendous investment put into this that were done in the 70s and the 60s. It would be a tremendous shame for us to just watch these deteriorate over time. And I'll talk a little bit further on that. In 2012, there was $5.5 million in the bonding available for public housing. We were one of the recipients of that, $405,000. You can see it toward the bottom on the left-hand side. Was very, very well received by us. I mean, in the sense that we were very grateful for it. And I'll talk about that in just a minute, too. And what I want to do now is just show you some pictures from my HRA. This is just a picture of downtown Red Wing. Right smack in the middle of this picture is the Jordan 1 and the Jordan 2 towers. Jordan 1 is the public housing unit. Jordan Towers 2 is the Section 8 new construction or it's project-based Section 8. They are home to about 220 people. Jordan Tower 1 is 100 units. Next. This is an example of a public housing project we have. It's called Pioneer Place. And remember, these are all been built in the 1970s. This houses about six families. And one of the things that's interesting, in our family units, the need for the subsidy is even greater than in our elderly units because the Social Security is available to them. And you'll see in a bit here how much the Social Security is. But in these units, we probably collect something in the neighborhood of about $175 tenant contribution toward their rents. These, if they were on the market, would rent for over $1,000 a month. So that's the difference that we're subsidizing them at. This is another example, Featherstone Court, six units in duplex style. And Deer Run Apartments, six more units. And this is an example of a single-family house in Red Wing that houses a family. And I mentioned it earlier about Jordan Towers 1. This is our 100-unit project. And I just want to mention to you that the average income in this project is about $13,400. And if we were to do the math, and they pay about $353 a month in rent. If they were to go across the street and live one of the market houses, they'd pay $620 just like that, maybe more, $800 a month for their rent. So you can see the critical need for this kind of housing. So we have 119 units in all in Red Wing, and I'm feeling that I felt it would be, you know, right for me to say that. Let's just imagine if these were replaced at $175,000 per unit or $150,000 a unit. If you don't like those numbers, you can choose one that you like. But it's somewhere between a replacement value of $18 million and $20 million. On a 100-year-old project, that means that we should be putting in back into this project to maintain it at about $180,000 to $200,000 per year. What we received for the federal government for this project to do that and those 119 units is $65,000 a year. So you can automatically see there's a big gap. I wanted to bring this slide to your attention here because this shows on the upper left-hand corner, that's my board of commissioners. On the right-hand upper corner is a meeting of tenants at a tenant meeting we hold monthly. Down below is a gathering of people to have a going-away party for one of my staff members, actually. And then over on the lower right-hand side is our resident council in Red Wing, Jordan Towers. And the reason I wanted to bring these to you is that these are real people we're dealing with. We're not just talking about buildings. We're talking about people that live and exist in these projects.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to leave I have a bill up in another committee, so I really appreciate that you're here, Mr. Hammerlin. I've got a question related to manufactured housing, and in my Senate district, I have 8 mobile home parks with up to 250 units in each park. Some are from the 60s, and they're really in really good condition, and they're providing long-term, low-cost housing for low-income residents, not only in my suburbs, but as I see all over Minnesota. Are any groups, and as Ms. Coppola told us, that $100 million will create 500 units, and you're talking $150,000 to $175,000 a unit, are any groups considering manufactured housing in mobile home parks where a rental or ownership housing is not available currently?
Mr. Hamlin.
Yes. Thank you for that question, Senator. That is a very good question. I think what one of our issues that we have to deal with when it comes to manufactured housing is not just the building that comes to the park itself, but the parks that are out there. And what we've seen the last few years is there has not been very many developments in that area whatsoever. So what happens is it's hard for people to find a place to actually park that manufactured housing. They have to find a lot of their own. But we also have to think about the standards that the lenders are looking at in order to, if they're selling the manufactured park or the manufactured housing and if they're putting it on a lot, to make sure that it meets the standards that they're willing to lend on. There hasn't been a lot of activity, in my opinion, on this, to be perfectly frank with you.
Members, for those that are coming up to testify, we have the room here, I think, until about 2:45. Then there's another committee that's coming in. So we'll have to kind of keep things moving along. So, all right.
Senator, I'm almost done.
Okay.
All right. I just wanted to say that we did receive that $405,000 in the what they call public housing operating program. And one of the things that's important, not only did it fix up my elevators and also a tub room and a restrooms for handicap accessibility and helping the residents, but we also use Minnesota contractors to do this job. So we've got Finn Daniels out of St. Paul, Schumacher out of St. Paul, and VDA elevators out of Minneapolis, and then Red Wing Construction. And some quick facts, maybe we can go over that. And then one last thing. In summary, Minnesota NARO supports the request for $100 million in bonds for affordable housing, and we also support the $20 million request to be used by PHAs and HRAs. And I just wanted to show you this picture. This is Nada Peters. She's of our Jordan Tower 1. She won an Emmy for her story that was ran on Care 11 regarding her needlepoint artwork. and she is a former HRA resident commissioner. Again, these are just great people that we're working with, and they need this assistance. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And, a lot of information there to chew on. Next, we have Mr. Washburn.
Mr. Chair, can I just add, there were some really good slides. Can we get those as well?
Yes. Is it possible that we can get a copy of your slides so that we can reproduce them?
It is.
Mr. Washburn. And I think I'll take this opportunity before Mr. Washburn just to thank all the people that have taken the time off to come to the Capitol. And it's a very important issue, one that I think a lot of just your presence here has demonstrated the importance of the issue. So thank you very much for coming. Welcome, Mr. Washburn, if you could give your name for the record.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Jeff Washburn. I serve as the Executive Director of the City of Lakes Community Land Trust in Minneapolis. I also serve as the current chair for the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak on behalf of this request for $100 million in bond funds. It's a great opportunity for the state, and I just want to speak to a very small portion of that does work for community land trusts. This Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition represents 9 community land trusts across the state, and we're part of a larger network of about 250 community land trusts nationally. Here in the state of Minnesota, there are over 1,200 community land trust homeowners who have been able to purchase homes through, by and large, a lot of state support over the years. Within that 1,200 homeowners figure, that includes about 1,000, a bit over 1,000 community land trust homes now across the state of Minnesota, and about 200 resales, and I'll speak just briefly to why those resales are so very important. Community land trusts essentially help folks buy homes here in the city in the state of Minnesota. And by and large, we're assisting households that want to buy homes in the state, but they don't have enough mortgage financing to be able to purchase a home. So community land trust affordability investments bridge the amount that somebody can get a mortgage for and the amount that the actual cost of the home. So here in Minnesota, the way that community land trusts primarily work is that a buyer can get a mortgage, and what our organizations do is come in and bridge that difference between the cost of the home and their mortgage. Key to that is that the funds that we invest in homeowners to help them purchase a home stay with the property, so that if and when the homeowner ever decides to sell their home, those funds stay in the transaction, and then if there's been a change in value in the property, if there's an increase in that value, a portion of that increase stays with the property as well, so we can keep those homes permanently affordable. And so over the years, we've as I've shared, now been able to help and facilitate over 200 resales in the state where that initial, by and large, state investment has stayed in the property, and we're not needing to reinvest funds into those homes to keep them affordable, a really strong investment of state funding. The state.
Sure. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Washburn, thank you for being here. Are those houses that you've helped finance, you know, with essentially kind of a gap finance, how many of those houses have been foreclosed upon and returned back to the bank?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, thank you for the question. I looked into these numbers in anticipation of conversation today. As of, and so we're not reflective of 2013 figures, as of the end of 2012, there had been 44 homes where homeowners had lost their homes. Not all those went into foreclosure. In many cases, our organization stepped up and repurchased them prior to the foreclosure process running itself through. But there had been 44 instances where homeowners had lost their homes over the figure of over 1,200 over the life of about 20 years. When you look at some of, when you look at when some of the first community land trusts were started, the bulk of us have been around for about 10 years.
So, Mr. Senator Hayden, so do you know what the percentage of that is relative to what the percentage nationally or even statewide was?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I don't have the exact percentage of what those differences are and how that plays out. I do know my organization's figures, and I don't know if that would be helpful in this context.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, well, actually, that's just give me some context.
Sure.
even if it's your organization relative to what happened in the rest of Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, within our organization, we've had 8 instances where homeowners have lost their home to foreclosure over the last 10 years. Annualized, and we looked at it just because the first foreclosure was just 5 years ago, annualized over 5 years, it's 1.2% of our total portfolio of land trust homes, compared to, in Minneapolis, a 1.9% foreclosure rate. So homeowners are about 50% less likely, in our case, to fall into foreclosure than other homeowners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. So the state of Minnesota, through the legislature and the Housing Finance Agency, have been incredibly supportive of community land trusts. And the vast majority of community land trusts have benefited from one form or another of state investment, whether it be through the Challenge, or now known as the Impact Fund. A lot of state mortgages have been made in community land trust homeowners. And then more recently, and I think specific to this opportunity, is that 2 years ago, through the state legislature, the state finance agency created an opportunity for us to also take advantage of infrastructure bonds. And so less than $2 million, but a significant amount for us, was invested into land trusts 2 years ago using the infrastructure bonds. And it's worked tremendously well for us, and I think it's another creative way for community land trusts to take a great opportunity for funding, leverage it with a number of other local sources, and in many cases we leverage the state investment by 2 to 4 times that amount, and then ensure that home buyers that otherwise would not have an opportunity to purchase homes in our state have a chance to purchase those homes. And then, again, key to the community land trust is that those investments stay with the properties, resale upon resale, given the land trust's interest in the property. And this is a great opportunity for us. If it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce City of Lakes Community Land Trust homeowner who also coincidentally lives in Senator Champion's district, just to talk a little bit about her homeownership experience.
Great. Thank you.
Her name, for the record, is Letitia Selman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Washburn. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you all for taking the time to hear from me. Like Jeff said, my name is Letitia Selman. I'll be in my house coming up on 7 years this coming May. I'm a mother of 2. I've recently married. At the time I bought my house, I was a single mom with 2 kids. As he said, I live in North Minneapolis, Shingle Creek neighborhood, Senator Champion's neighborhood, area, and I'm a recipient of a land trust home. 7 years, and I love it. On my own, I would not have been able to afford a home that met the needs of me and my family at that time. I wanted to buy a home, but I didn't want to just buy what I could afford to live in. I needed to buy a home that met the needs of my family structure, which were my son and daughter each having their own room, me having a room, them having a yard to play in the backyard, a place to hold family gatherings at holiday time. And so without the assistance of the City of Lakes Community Land Trust, that would not have been possible. My kids are stable. They go to a great school. We're actively involved in our neighborhood. Prior to purchasing, I was just a working person. I didn't really care what was going on around in my neighborhood because I was more concerned about taking care of me and my kids and getting to work. And now that I'm a homeowner, I'm in a community, you're paying more attention to the things that are happening around you and who your neighbors are, and something as simple as picking up the trash in the neighborhood and things like that. And I'm grateful for my opportunity to have purchased my home through the City of Lakes. I didn't need to do anything. I didn't need to fix a roof. I haven't had anything break as of yet, luckily. And my relationship with them makes me comfortable that when I do need to do something, they would be who I could call. They'd have the resources for the contractors or whoever that would be best to come out and help me take care of my home to keep it up and running and going. So, and from that relationship, I joined the board. I've been on the board since I've purchased my home, and I'm a part of helping make that change in my community and keep getting families in the homes that they need for their families. Thank you.
You mentioned that you had 9 trusts in Minnesota. Is there a certain number of homes in one trust, or, and then also kind of where are those trusts? Are they in the metropolitan area? Are there in some other areas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so there are 9 community land trusts across the state of Minnesota. Our organization, representing the city of Minneapolis. There's another organization called Homes Within Reach that serves the balance of Hennepin County, the Rondo Community Land Trust in Ramsey County, the Carver County, HRA, CDA, is represented by Brenda Lano, representing Carver County. There's a Washington County Community Land Trust. The 2 largest community land trusts are actually in greater Minnesota, one in Duluth. Approximately about 300 homeowners have been assisted with their community land trust in the greater Duluth area by an organization called One Roof Housing. And then in the Rochester area, I believe they've also assisted about 300 homeowners, and their organization is called First Homes. Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership has started a branch of their organization that is focused on community land trust home ownership. There's also a community land trust represented by the Central Minnesota Housing Partnership. And I believe that is all of them, Senator. Okay,
great. Thank you. Sounds like it's a growing phenomena or tool.
If I may, Senator, Mr. Chair, as we talk about, and I've heard several references to the continuum of affordable housing, I think community land trusts provide an incredible tool to bridge that space between rental housing and outright conventional home ownership. And it's a bridge to help folks do better for themselves, do better for their families, and invest in the community that, unfortunately, we don't have the prices and or maybe the wages in the state that allow folks to do that on their own.
Great. Thank you very much.
If I may, Mr. Chair, introduce Brenda Lano, who's the director with the Carver County Community Land Trust.
Hi. We're unique in that we took over what was the Chaska Land Trust when they struggled and didn't have funding to continue their mission. They'd come to the CDA and asked us if we could operate the program. So if we are a community development organization, this is a program that we operate. But the model works, and what we have seen, Chaska Land Trust was started in 2003. That's when they brought in their first home. So it's been about 11 years. And in that time, we have grown. We've taken it just from Chaska throughout the communities of Carver County. We currently have 25 homes. We've helped 36 families in that time. So that means we've had 11 resales. In those 11 resales, we've had 80% of the people sell and go into the traditional market. And 96% of our homeowners work within our communities. We have nurses, we have teachers, we have landscapers, we have a social worker. They come from all walks of life, but our housing is expensive, and as you've seen, 30% is what you should be paying for your housing. So this model works. It keeps people invested in their communities. They have pride of ownership, and they support the model. They ask that more people get this opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Lano. Great. Any questions? Next, we thank you very much for being here and testifying. Mr. Eilers, is it?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and fellow committee members. I am from Common Bond Communities. We are a nonprofit affordable housing developer, property manager, and service provider. I've been asked to talk a little bit more about some of the services and how we pair that with housing, which is an important part of this this request in terms of bonds. So Commons Bond's mission is to build stable homes, strong futures, and vibrant communities. We have over 80 affordable multifamily developments throughout the state, not just in the Twin Cities, but also Aitken, Red Wing, Sleepy Eye, Annandale, Little Falls, and things like that. Over 7,500 people are in our housing communities in the state, and those types of housing that we provide range from general occupancy and family housing to homeless supportive housing and senior independent living types of housing. So In terms of the success of our residents, we found that our services division, which is our advantage services division, is a key component to the success for all of our residents. The majority of our properties have some sort of a presence of services on site that we provide. Just the depth of those services range depending on the type of property. But in terms of our general occupancy buildings, we often have study buddy tutoring that we provide, learning circles for early education, financial literacy and career enhancement classes. In some of our senior developments, we provide wellness and exercise activities that can range from yoga to different types of things. Computer lab assistance. With all of our new construction, we provide a computer lab that people can access free of charge any time of day that they can use. And then we also are on site, and we have coordinators that help provide referrals to different agencies throughout the community in all of our sites. The types of services that we provide and more of these mainstream models are evidence-based practices, and we found that they have provided some tremendous results that I'd like to share with you. In terms of teenagers and those that participate in our after-school tutoring plans and different types of services, we have a 90% success rate in terms of graduating high school, and that's not only graduating high school but also choosing to move on to higher education. So that rate, you know, given our population, that would be considered in different types of housing, that it betters the state rate of just general high school graduation. And not only do they graduate, but also choose to go on to higher education. 71% of the kids that are in our programming that are below grade level in math and reading make progress and better and average, not only do average, but get better and progress in terms of their skills as long as they're in our programming. Over 10,000 hours of volunteer interaction were recorded last year, and that brings in not only people that are our property managers and our service coordinators, but that means we're recruiting and bringing in people from the community in the neighborhood to come in and build those bonds, not only with the residents, but also, you know, for a greater community and stabilization. Last year, over 700 at-risk seniors that were living in our properties were able to stay on site in our housing and live independently rather than moving on to assisted living or nursing home or far more expensive care, and that we feel like that has been a tremendous upfront benefit or a way of preventing people from losing their health. Some of our more in-depth types of services that we provide for our essentially like our homeless properties. We also have a property that is focused on those with multiple sclerosis. That involves more intensive case management that we can do. Again, referral to community services, personal budgeting assistance and financial assistance, resident counseling, and then also community building activities. Those can be discussion circles or different types of, you know, voluntary interactions to have people build community within each of our buildings or each of our properties. This supportive type of housing for those that are homeless or those most at risk allows people to remain in place and stay stabilized in the face of a very volatile housing situation that they've experienced in the past. And an important statistic is that in our housing, 85% of people that are at risk of losing their housing or have an at-risk situation because of our advantage services on site with our within our properties, 85% of those at risk of losing housing see a resolution. We're able to step in and connect them, work with counties, work with cities, work with different providers to keep them stabilized and in our housing and safe. I'll close with some of the ways that housing infrastructure bonds really came in to provide success in terms of housing in the past. A common bond was a grateful recipient of more than one award of housing infrastructure bonds back in a couple years ago. It included the preservation of 125 units of very low-income housing for seniors in Maplewood. We were able to rejuvenate their building, provide better community supports for them, provide better amenities and outdoor activities. our project in North Minneapolis, which was on a foreclosure area, was mentioned earlier by the commissioner. And that allowed that's going to allow 54 households to live affordably in a brand new, very nice apartment where they can be stable and have an affordable rent that they can pay. And that will have a computer lab, community space, public art, and things like that along the. And finally, we also have a project that's about to get underway that will serve 58 households of homeless veterans that will be in Fort Snelling. And that will be supportive housing for them and provide quality services in connection with the VA and also referrals to different agencies to make sure that that will be a quality historic rehabilitation for the property.
Okay. A question. You mentioned housing infrastructure bonds several times. Is part of the housing infrastructure bond, I mean, you use the housing infrastructure bond, but in the RFP that goes to the department, you spell out kind of the requirements, that are the things that you just mentioned, a lot of the services, a lot of the things that you would provide along with the housing.
Yeah, that's correct.
Is that kind of how this all works?
So we know with the availability of those bonds and our response to the RFP from Minnesota Housing, we spelled out our project, how we'd use the money, and how it meets their priority areas.
Sure. Okay. That's very it's a great way to, you know, develop the right kind of housing for those circumstances. So. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for being here, Mr. Ehlers. And please give your name for the...
Julie Gergen.
Okay, thank you, Julie.
Yes, thank you all for having me here and allowing me to tell my story. I actually was a homeowner for 13 years, and due to some health issues, I wasn't able to work any longer, so I couldn't afford my mortgage, and I ended up having to go into foreclosure. I was then homeless for 4 years. I, you know, went from friends' house to families to shelters, and it just wasn't a good thing. It wasn't a good feeling at all. I then was accepted to live at Higher Ground. And I thank God for that every day. I get a beautiful apartment to live in. They're just wonderful, wonderful people. And without the assistance I get for my rent, I couldn't afford to pay, you know, the normal rate for rent. And so I'm just so blessed that I have this beautiful home to live in, you know, with wonderful people, wonderful staff, and I just... You know, living on the streets, especially being a female, that was a really scary thing. And I wouldn't want to ever do it again or have to see anybody else do it again. And like I said, with the rental assistance I get, I'm able to stay in my home. And without it, I don't know what I would do. So I'm just really hoping that, you know, things go the way they should so everybody can stay in their home.
Is Ms. Gergen, is the Higher Ground, and actually I think some of the members of this committee are going to be going over to look at the Higher Ground project. Is it strictly apartments, or is there what could you describe
it, well,
a little bit of?
It's strictly apartments. There is a shelter for men on the first level, and then the rest of them are apartments. From 2 to 7th floor. Okay. And they're efficiency apartments, very nice. You know, some of the levels that we have, like mine, I have a full kitchen and a bathroom in it. And some of the other ones, they share, you know, the men share a bathroom and or a kitchen, because there's only 4 of us that are women that live in the whole building. So.
And how many residents do they have in total?
85.
Okay. Great. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sharing that. If you could give your name for the record, please.
My name is Randy Ruhannon. Thank you for having me and letting me share my story.
Thank you.
So, hi, my name is Randy. I'm a 24-year-old single mother of twins. I'm here to share my story and experience with Center City Housing and their programs. In April of 2010, I got an apartment in the program because I found myself homeless, addicted to drugs, and with no experience on how to survive. It was a hard reality considering in 2008, I graduated high school with a 3.9 GPA and was captain of the cheerleading squad. My story is not one of an abusive home or years of trauma. It's one that, even with a good upbringing, I still experienced homelessness. Being homeless for me meant I couch hopped, lived out of my car, and had to do things that compromised my self-esteem for people to have a place to stay. During this time, I became addicted to OxyContin, which began a few years earlier for selling them for my mom. They were her prescriptions. For those of you who don't know, OxyContin is a highly addictive narcotic pain reliever, also referred to as synthetic heroin. I also became pregnant during this time with my high school boyfriend, who had become abusive due to his own drug use. I became so physically addicted that I would shoot up while pregnant because I was scared if I didn't, my babies would die from withdrawals. I remember being pregnant and crying myself to sleep because I knew what I was doing was wrong. While using, I stole from my friends and became a compulsive liar. I lost a lot of respect and trust from almost everyone who cared and loved me. It became a life I lived only to get high. I was running out of places to stay and ended up in Safe Haven, a shelter for domestic violence victims. From there, I was connected with a woman's advocate I knew and secured my apartment. It was a fairly simple and easy process to get in. During the intake process, they helped me get into treatment with the assurance of having a place to stay afterwards. I spent 2 months in treatment and successfully completed. I came home and shortly after gave birth to my babies. When I came home from the hospital, I had my own prescription for opiates. I began selling and using again, but this time I was in an environment where I had people to hold me accountable. There was always a constant reminder that I was a mom and could and would lose my children if I continued. They constantly reminded me that it was my responsibility to give my kids the life they deserved. Living in a community where people are still just surviving has been hard, but it has also helped me have a constant reminder of where I don't want to go back to. My support staff helped me understand the reality of using drugs while pregnant and what my children still face developmentally. My children are Native American, so they helped me connect with services that are culturally appropriate. I've learned a lot about what was needed in order for them to thrive. I have learned different techniques to help my children because they are sensory focused and respond well to that kind of therapy. Parenting has been a huge challenge and continues to be something I need support for. My twin boys are 3 years old. They're energetic, never still, and seek sensations that include flooding my apartment numerous times, destroying walls, carpets, and cupboards. They have broken just about everything that you can break, including screens, drawers, TVs, sink sprayers. The list could go on and on. Any other landlord would have evicted me because of what they have done. They have both been diagnosed with sleep disorders, behavior disorders, expressive and receptive language disorders, and sensory processing issues. One of them has a developmental delay. It's hard to hear that one of my boys is likely going to have a disability that he will struggle with and most likely need medication to cope. Even though the psychologist who diagnosed my kids said it's not related to their exposure to opiates, I constantly wonder and blame myself that it's my fault because of the drugs. I have daily supports in parenting as well as goals. Since being in the program, I have received support with staying sober, making and completing goals, and my mental health. I started my CNA and was not able to complete because I didn't have the proper supports in place. Instead of giving up, the program has helped me assess and secure the right supports so I can go back. They help keep me motivated and are invested in all of our success. They are there when I want to give up, reminding me of how far I have come and to keep going. In spite of what my boys have been through, they are able to count past 10. They can identify every letter in the alphabet, along with shapes and colors. They are starting to name feelings, help with chores, and their attention continues to increase. They are being regulated more every day. My housing program has a child care program called TOTS. This is a daycare program Monday through Friday from 9 until 11 for children ages birth to 5 years. They do preschool activities, go on outings, do crafts, and so much more. They also have a program for the older kids called Fusion. It's an after-school program where the kids can go to get help with homework, and they also bring them on outings such as movies and skating and other activities they may not be able to partake in otherwise. They also offer social and support groups to help the people in our community connect with other participants in the program and other services they may need, such as parenting or early childhood family education. Without this program, there's no telling where I would be. Today, I am a completely different person than I was when I first entered. The program has given me the tools I need to deal with my life. Today, I'm sober, and I'm getting my kids the help they need and deserve. Most importantly, I am content with where I'm at in life at this point. My children and I have a safe, stable living environment, and we are getting the services we need. I know I still have a long way to go, but I am confident I will get there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing those personal experiences. And could you just very kind of briefly talk about where Safe Haven is, and are you still there?
No. Okay. Safe Haven is in Duluth, Minnesota. It's a domestic violence shelter for women mostly. I'm in a permanent supportive housing program through Center City Housing. So I'm in permanent supportive housing.
So. Also in Duluth.
Yeah, Duluth, oh, okay. Minnesota, sorry.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, it's you know, so hard to, you know, for many of us to comprehend the difficulties that so many go through, you know, and especially if you don't have someplace safe to be and a shelter over your head. So, but Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And is it Ms. Hall?
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Leah Hall. I'm a housing project manager at the Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency. That's AEOA. I would like to start by thanking Senator Stump for authoring the bill for $100 million on affordable housing bonds and the co-authors on the committee, Senator Tomasoni, Senjem, Hayden, and Peterson. Thank you so much for your work on this. So AEOA is a community action organization based out of Virginia on the Iron Range. For over 48 years, AEOA has provided opportunities for households that face economic and social challenges in Northeast Minnesota, through a wide range of programming that focus on creating opportunities that help communities in Northeast Minnesota thrive. AEOA Housing addresses homelessness, generates workforce housing, provides low-income families safe places to live, and ensures that seniors on moderate fixed incomes are able to safely age in place. I work for AEOA because I believe that safe, decent housing is not only something that every community needs, but that safe, decent housing is also a human right. Currently, I'm working on a project that I think is an excellent example of how the proposed Homes for All housing infrastructure bonds could be used to not only preserve existing affordable housing, but can also support local efforts to address homelessness. The Ivy Manor is an apartment complex in downtown Virginia that currently houses very low-income households. The manor is also home to many formerly homeless households that AEOA and other service providers serve, given low rents and the central location. Of the current tenants, 71% of them are disabled and receiving Social Security. 26 of them have an annual gross income of under $10,000 a year. The highest annual income in the complex for a tenant is $20,508 per year, as noted in a recent tenant characteristic report. AEOA's plan is to acquire and rehabilitate the Ivy Manor. This historic building was built in 1923 and has 46 units. 5 of them, however, are offline given their condition. Examples of some of the rehabilitation work that the apartments require include electrical, plumbing, mechanical upgrades, along with unit improvements in the kitchens, bathrooms, and some floor plan changes to improve unit functionality, and much more regarding common space improvements and storage. AUA also plans to designate 18 of these existing units as permanent supportive housing. These units would have a rental subsidy attached to them, so tenants would be required to pay only 30% of their income. We would include case management services, so homeless households receive ongoing support to keep their housing and improve their overall well-being. Finally, we plan to convert several of the single-bedroom units into two-bedroom units, so we're also able to serve homeless families. We've done the preliminary planning with a local mental health agency that can provide the case management and also base a staff person right there on site. We've also connected with other local partners that can provide rental assistance and deliver specialized property management. We see this project as the perfect opportunity to preserve existing affordable housing in a historic building and also create subsidized housing by leveraging resources that already exist in our community. Together with our partners, we can make this project happen, but one of our biggest challenges is securing capital funds to rehabilitate the building, given the extremely limited amount of local resources that we could raise. In order to ensure that rents can be held at an affordable level, we could only access a very limited amount of standard bank loans. Projects like this simply cannot generate the income to support market rate debt. However, this funding gap can be covered by investments in housing like the proposed bonding money. We are very hopeful that we will bring this project to life by securing capital funds through the upcoming Minnesota Housing Finance Agency funding round this year, and that through the Homes for All request, housing infrastructure bonds can be available to support this project and other valuable projects across the state. I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hall. Is this somewhat common for community action agencies to try to move forward on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question. There are actually a few of us community action agencies here in Minnesota that do housing development. We are working very hard to increase that throughout our community action network. And in fact, we kind of lean on each other, our expertise. And with this project specifically, we've been working with Three Rivers Community Action Agency for a little bit of TA to make sure something like this can happen in our region.
Great.
Chairman?
Senator Thomas.
Chairman, and the AUA is a pretty interesting organization in that it's seven counties, right, that you – it's six or seven counties that you oversee?
Yes, that's correct. Yes Senator.
It's six or seven. Six?
It depends on the service, but seven is the most. Seven. Yes, sir.
And they've grown from a $10 million agency in the early 90s to a $30 million agency. And it's sort of an inverse relationship to the needs. I mean, it's kind of like that, you know, more and more people are needing their services, which is, you know, going in the wrong direction as far as society is concerned. And they've had to actually keep getting bigger and bigger to try and accommodate the different people that they're serving. And so this housing thing that they're doing is just kind of fits in with all the different type of individuals that they have to serve. And so it's they do a great job in what they're doing. It's unfortunate that they have to keep getting bigger, though, is kind of what it amounts to.
Yeah, Senator Thomas, early on, and you were here, I think, where they said that, I think it was Commissioner, was talking about how the number of homeless, we can keep kind of approaching a goal, but that goal just keeps growing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure we'll be able to take care of the whole problem this time, but we're certainly going to try to do as much as we can.
Well, they have a good author on the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. have you looked at, you said that like local lenders, the disparity is just too much. And the cost is too high for interest and everything, so it doesn't work out.
Correct. Yes, Mr. Chair. So we do put in a bit of what we call amortizing or market rate debt in projects of this magnitude, but you have to be very careful. As we mentioned, a project like this, if we want to hold the rents at a very low rate, we are unable to manage that type of rent. Unlike a for-profit developer that would make sure that their operating numbers worked out by taking on more private debt and increasing the rents to cover that debt load, we'd not want to do that, so we can make sure this is affordable.
Great. Well, thank you very much for
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sharing.
Thank you so much for your time.
Mr. Thielen?
Yep.
Welcome. Please give your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Thielen. I'm CEO of Sand Companies. We're a private for-profit developer with our home office in Wade Park. I'm here to talk a little bit about the workforce needs in greater Minnesota and really highlight it's not just a metro issue, it's really a statewide issue. And hopefully these housing infrastructure bonds can help kind of ease this housing challenge that we have going on. We've developed and own and manage about 30 affordable rental housing projects. About a quarter of those are in the greater Minnesota area. And I attended some of the listening sessions that the commissioner had brought up. It was interesting to hear down in southwestern Minnesota how an employer in Worthington is busing employees in every single day from Sioux Falls because of the lack of available housing there. And also talked with the communities of Thief River Falls and War Road, met with them, and Roseau also, and just to hear what's going on in those areas. And we were fortunate enough to get a project selected through the RFP last year in Roseau that we're working on to try to start construction yet this summer. Other thing, the challenge has really brought out was really housing partnerships that are really unique. The project we're working on Roseau is one of our project partners is Polaris Industries, who's the major employer there, and they're participating with potentially about $1 million in the project. So you hear them talk to housing about them, their eyes just glaze over. They just say, what do we need to do to get it done? So that is really unique, I think, that's going on. We've sat down with Marvin Windows and talked with them, similar ideas. So the housing challenge out there, everybody really recognizes and wants to participate. The problem in greater Minnesota is you can't really drive. The rents are just too low to really make some of the projects work. And because housing costs, the construction costs are all not different in greater Minnesota than the metro area. So there's that housing gap. So it's really key to get some initial money like we had on the Roseau project from the state to add these other leverage dollars in from other areas. And on the housing preservation side, specifically tied to the infrastructure bonds, is really key in greater Minnesota also. We have a project in St. Cloud we're looking to rehab, and that's a preservation project that we're looking to use in this funding. It's a 32-unit townhome project, a little over 20 years old. And the renovation costs are about $70,000 per unit. To rebuild that and do new affordable units versus losing those potential units would easily be double that. And with the funding sources we're looking for, we can leverage about half those dollars, half of that cost, with hopefully federal tax credits, so we're using federal dollars, along with amortizing debt, which covers about 35%, and that remaining piece of about 15% would be some type of deferred funding from that we'd be requesting. So there certainly is a need, and we've used the housing infrastructure bonds on projects, and it really helped statewide. It frees up a lot of other resources.
Yeah, it was very interesting, attending some of the meetings up in Roseau, and some of it was actually, at least this was some of the information that came out, that the people up there all had jobs. I mean, basically, there's almost no unemployment because of the demand. So what happened is that the homes were a little, at least in the residential homes, were a little too expensive for them they just wouldn't buy them. And I think I'll toss this out, but I think it was like about $160,000, $180,000 per home. And the difference where they would buy it would be about $140,000, just with their incomes and everything. And I think even though in the discussion they might be able to finance and buy a house that's at like $160,000 or $180,000, they just wouldn't do it because they were afraid of not being able to carry that debt. So, I mean, sometimes it's a somewhat of a narrow margin between buying a house, and we talked about, well, how do you lower that price of that house? You know, do you leave the basement unfinished or not do something in the house or, you know, to try to bring that down? And it is, you know, I think it's a common problem where they have a salary that's not quite good enough to purchase that house. I mean, I think up in Polaris it's probably about $15-$17 an hour that they're making, but you know, it's not quite enough. And so you have to find some kind of a way to adjust it. And that's, you know, before we had Mr. Washburn was talking about the land trust where you offset that. And then I think we have a bill, I'm not sure, I think I'm maybe the author of it, on the tax increment financing. Another tool to try to figure out how you can lower that initial investment. And you mentioned the infrastructure bonds, too, which is essential, you know, to make it all work.
Yep, Mr. Chair, that's a really good point. The other thing we've seen, too, as a long-term owner of housing, too, is I think still people are even still a little bit concerned about buying at this time. They've seen what happened in the last how many years. Even in areas of like Roseau, there's some housing opportunities to buy, but still, you know, you have a job today, tomorrow, you know, what about the next day? There's still a little bit of a question in people's mind. Are they willing to make that jump? So it's really putting a strain on the rental housing, just the lack of it. At least that's what we've been seeing. And we've been talking to lots of employers in those areas, and, you know, they're very upset about the lack of housing. And we've heard from Polaris that, you know, if we don't get some housing like this, you know, it's going to be, you know, they're not sure where they're going to be. So it's great to see some things moving forward. These housing infrastructure bonds are really a big deal for all the housing. Another resource that the agency has.
Senator Tomasoni's going to take care of that, huh? Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could, in closing, just thank you and the committee for spending this time talking about housing, your leadership on it. What we've tried to do with the panel of testifiers is to demonstrate the wide range of needs, the geographic kind of disparities and needs. And then as a Homes for All Alliance, what we've done is over the past few years, we've brought all of those folks together around the same table and tried to figure out what can we do to tackle this. And this $100 million bonding request is exactly what we all, very unified on, think we need to tackle this. And through the process we've discussed that Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has, where they look at very competitively, people have to make their case for how they're leveraging these dollars, what services they're providing. We really do think we can make the smartest investments in communities large and small across the state. So thanks for your leadership, and thanks for spending your time with us today.
Thank you very much for, you know, helping put this together, and all of those that have come and testified and shared their stories. It's a very important part of all of our lives, so we appreciate it very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to working with you. Members, before you... I think most of them took off, but if you're around tomorrow, we're going to visit a couple places.